Acts 29 and 30 today. So we'll chant 29. Jeneshu Dajamanishu Amalo Bhadavagnina Nipapashyagnina Mukto Gangam Basta Ivadvipa Jeneshu Dajamanishu Amalo Bhadavagnina Yatapyasyagnina Mukto Gangam Basta Ivadvipa Jeneshu Dhyamanishu Amalo Bhadavagnina Tapyasyagnina Mukto Gangam Basta Ivadvipa is. Even while they are burning. Kama of lust. Lobha and greed. Deva Agmina in the forest fire. Natapashe, you are not burned. Agmina from the fire. Mukta, free. Ganga Amba in the water of the Ganga. Standing. Iva, as if. Dvipa, an elephant. Translation and purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Although all people within the material world are burning in the great forest fire of lust and greed, you remain free and are not burned by that fire. You are just like an elephant who takes shelter from a forest fire by standing within the water of the Ganges River. Report. The natural result of transcendental bliss is described in this verse. The young Brahmin was physically very attractive, and his senses were full of potency for material enjoyment. Yet he was not at all affected by material lust. This position is called mukti, or liberation. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains that within the Ganges flow great currents of water capable of extinguishing a blazing fire. If an elephant maddened by sex desire stands within the Ganges, its powerful cooling currents extinguishes lust, and the elephant becomes pacified. Similarly, ordinary human beings trapped in the cycle of birth and death are constantly harassed by the enemies of lust and greed, which never allow the mind to be completely peaceful. But if following the example of the elephant, One situates oneself within the cooling waves of transcendental bliss, then all material desire will soon be extinguished, and one will become shanta, or peaceful. As described in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Bhakta Nishkama Atayava Shanta. Thus everyone should take to the movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and cleanse himself in the cooling waters of Krishna consciousness, our real eternal consciousness. And then text 30, Tvam hina prachitam brahman atmanyanandakaranam ruhi sparsha vihina sya bhavata kevalatmana. O Brahman, we see that you are devoid of any contact of material enjoyment and that you are traveling alone without any companions or family members. Therefore, because we are sincerely inquiring from you, please tell us the cause of the great ecstasy that you are feeling within yourself. Report. The word kevalatmana is significant here. Unless one has practical realization of the Supreme Soul and the individual soul reside together within the heart of every living being, it is very difficult to artificially adopt the sannyas order of life and travel without the association of wife, children, and other family members. The nature of every living being is to make friends with others and to offer his love to a suitable person. One who has realized the Supreme Person is satisfied to always carry the personality of Godhead within his heart as his constant companion. And thus one has realized that Krishna is one's only true friend and that Krishna is within one's heart, one will remain attached to the temporary relationships of this material world. Om Jnana Kamanandasha Gananjana Salakaya Chakshilu Nitamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchako Patrivishcha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patitano Pavane Bhyo Vaishnave Bhyo Namo Namaha. So this is a discussion between King Yadu and the Avadhuta Brahmin, who is a young Brahmin who King Yadu has come across, who is very, very renounced, very detached. This Avadhuta indicates one who has almost no contact with the material world, is in a situation where one almost doesn't interact with the material world, but remains just completely fixed within. But of course, he's going to speak transcendental knowledge. And in these verses, King Yadu is glorifying his situation. First, we see that he's surprised that such a young, healthy man would be free from any material desires. And it's discussed how it's that inner spiritual happiness that he's experiencing that frees him from the pushing of those desires. The example is given in this first verse of the blazing fire. It's described that if the fire is going blazing throughout the woods or the forest, the elephant may stand in the middle of the river, the Ganges, and be completely protected from that fire. So this blazing fire is often given in our scriptures as an analogy. Of course, in the very first verse of Guru Vastam, we hear samsara dhavana lida loka, that the world is afflicted by this blazing fire of material existence. But, of course, the elephant, as he is protected within the water, similarly, the living entity within this blazing fire, the material world, is protected if one is connected with Krishna and is experiencing the inner peace of one's relationship with Krishna. So this strong statement of the blazing fire, which is describing material desires, is very true. And interestingly enough, in the reading that I think Keshava just picked by random, just before class today, that same idea of how strong lust is in this material world was described. So this is the problem. Everyone is assaulted by these material desires, and those material desires are, of course, based upon the senses, the mind, the bodily conception of life. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 10.20.42, it says, the autumn moon relieved all creatures of the suffering caused by the sun's rays, just as wisdom relieves a person of the misery caused by identifying with his material body. So, as we know, that's the bodily identification and identification with the desires that arise from our senses and mind that are actually a source of suffering. So the suffering is experienced by the senses, within the mind, intelligence, and the ego. In the purport today, the verse from Majjhalila 9.149 was quoted as Krishna Bhakta Nishkama Atayava Shanta. Because a devotee of Lord Krishna is desireless, he is peaceful. So, of course, that is what the goal is, to become free from the desires of the material world and thus to attain peace. But the reality of the material world, of course, is very different. People are not experiencing this peace. They're experiencing great suffering, great pain, great mental distress, physical distress. And as Prabhupada often says, nobody wants suffering, and yet it comes. So despite our desires for happiness and our desires for peacefulness, we experience the opposite so often within this material world. And any situation within this material world basically leads to the same result. Abha Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punar Bhartino Arjuna Bhamapecha Dukuntaya Punar Janmana Vijite. From the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. But one who attains to my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So we attempt to find happiness in this material world. Despite its failings, despite our constant suffering, and even though it seems to be that our desires for that happiness are thwarted every moment, still we try, life after life, birth after birth, in so many ways. And basically, as these purports are pointed out in these verses, we are trying to experience that happiness primarily through relationships with others. It's as it's described here that very surprising that this young Avadhuta Brahma can just travel alone. What is the word that's given? Kevalatmana. That he is alone. He doesn't need anyone else. He's self-satisfied than himself. That's unusual. And so it's remarkable. It's noted by King Yadu that he is in this situation, because that is not our normal situation. We usually find happiness through relationship. And in this purport, I thought this was a nice line that they mentioned. Our author said, "The nature of every living being is to make friends with others and to offer his love to a suitable person." So that's our nature. We find that those who are alone are very rarely happy. Unlike the Avadhuta Brahman, that's not the usual situation. And we even think about people who are hermits or loners. They're usually portrayed as kind of disturbed or unhappy people, right? Not like, oh, they're so happy living off by themselves in the woods, just enjoying. No, usually, I mean, I think of our classic example of remember Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber? Now, he was living alone in his cabin for 20 years or something, you know, no contact with others, so he just sat there and thought about how horrible everybody was and how he should kill them all, practically. And they're a very, very disturbed, unhappy person. So having no connection with others is usually not a healthy state. It's not good. You know, we need relationship. We need variety. We need all of these things because it's the nature of the soul. So to be psychologically healthy, everyone needs relationships. What's the difficulty? The difficulty, of course, is that material relationships are by their very nature imperfect. The purport said that we should try to offer our love to a suitable person. So unfortunately, we're often reposing our love, reposing our relationships with unsuitable persons. Those who cannot help us in spiritual life, but rather implicate us more and more in material life. Everybody wants this perfect relationship. And people are convinced there's a perfect relationship out there for them. People talk about finding their soulmate or their perfect love, someone who will complete them. That doesn't usually happen. Because what everybody is looking for is Radha and Krishna, right? Man is looking for Radharani, and the woman is looking for Krishna, and thinking that somehow this material person is going to satisfy them, is going to fulfill that relationship. And inevitably, there's disappointment. That disappointment is because this is just a, you know, living entity, a flawed human who cannot live up to that potential. So, nevertheless, people, lifetime after lifetime, throughout the centuries, have tried to find this perfect romantic love. Now, people sometimes experience a little glimpse of this. Some of you may remember or experience that sometimes right at the beginning of a relationship, there's this sort of, we call honeymoon period, or this time when people feel, you know, that this is very wonderful, that this is the perfect person, I'm completely in love. Now, there's psychological studies about this. You know, this is a known phenomena that even material psychologists understand. And they talk about this romance period. They say it lasts for about 1 month to a year maximum, and then it wears off. And this rush of just total love and absorption is actually related to levels of oxytocin in the brain. So, in other words, it's a chemical reaction, basically a chemical response that people experience. And then when that chemical response begins to fade off, we see the person leaves their dirty socks on the floor, you know, and doesn't take out the garbage and often gets angry or, you know, isn't really quite the sweet person that I thought they were 3 months ago when I first met them. Because that's life, that's reality. So what happens? Two things. A person becomes discouraged by this. Oh, this isn't the right person. It's really the fault of this person. They have to form a new relationship. And some people do this. They go from relationship to relationship, you know, trying to find that perfect love, being disappointed and going on. Now, other people who are a little more fortunate, a little more intelligent, they realize that, okay, this is the way it is, and they try to deepen that relationship into something meaningful. You know, and those relationships may last. If there's some actual substance, some actual emotional, relational connection there, it's beyond just some, you know, romantic idealism. I've talked about this one before, but so if you've heard it before, sorry. But my very favorite all-time Shakespeare play is Romeo and Juliet. Why? Because it's the greatest example of total illusion ever written. It's a wonderful example. Okay, what are they, 15, 16 years old? Right? They fall madly in love, haven't even met each other, you know, a couple, you know, nice soliloquies on the balcony, and, you know, this is like endless, timeless, eternal love that they experience, and in fact, they are so absorbed in this, and what do? They end up killing themselves, killing each other, or not killing each other, killing themselves, you know, for the sake of this great love. And this is like famous, Romeo and Juliet. This is like an ideal of love. Now, what's wrong with this? First of all, there's so many things. What's wrong with this picture? So many things. First of all, it's very brief. They're still in this honeymoon period, right? This sort of illusory period where they don't, you know, and so it's this very brief, it ends before it even starts. These characters are young adolescents, they have little experience of the world, it's completely idealized, and it's completely a mental creation. Did Romeo and Juliet actually know each other, who they were as persons? Did they have some, like, deep discussions about their goals in life and how they felt? No. It's a total mental concoction of, you know, this idealized personality, and it quickly ends. So why is this so popular? This is that these stories have enduring popularity, and love stories are in all of our music, right? All of our plays, our stories, television, movies, is always about, you know, romantic love is the theme, because everybody wants that. And it's almost, the more unrealistic it is, it's almost the more popular it is, because that's the ideal that people want. And it must be there. There's a story about it. Because the jiva wants something better than what they're experiencing. That's the reality. So material love is disappointing. No one can fulfill the expectations that the soul is actually hankering for in that perfect relationship, that spiritual relationship with God. Just to bring this point home a little more, our expectations in relationships become so skewed, so unrealistic, particularly in Western culture. In other cultures, it's kind of like marriage was okay, you know, the family's fine, this person looks like a good match, you know, it'll work out economically, maybe do a little astrology, looks like that they'll be compatible. Okay, you know, fine, you know, do your thing, get married, and hope for the best. And, you know, with, you know, a little bit, probably more realistic expectations, you know, in other cultures. So, you know, it's funny because in America, like, we, you know, tend to condemn arranged marriages like that. But actually, statistically, arranged marriages often work out better. You know, the people think if I pick the own person, you know, it'll be perfect. And it isn't. Because our divorce rate is 50%. Basically, half the time people are wrong. They're probably not very happy in the other 50%. You know, so it's not like people's, you know, own wonderful, you know, voluntary choices necessarily come out so well. I read this once before, but I found this again, and I wanted to read this. There was a qualitative research study on relationships by this Naomi Quinn, who's the professor emeritus of cultural anthropology from Duke University. And I'll just read a short portion of this, because it's interesting that even sometimes our materialistic psychologists have some understandings of what's going on. She said, provision of psychological fulfillment by each partner to the other is more than just contractual. It derives moral imperative from its place in the modern concept of personhood. Being fulfilled has come to be regarded by Americans as something of a natural right. Since marriage or like relationships is deemed to be the primary, if not only the locus of such fulfillment, the kind that can only be met by another person, such a relationship itself becomes necessary to self-completion. So when the expectations are that high, that one person is going to fulfill everything that I need, it's almost doomed to failure, isn't it? Because our expectation that any one person can fulfill all of our needs and desires is totally unrealistic, won't happen, and it's simply not possible because we're all fallible living entities, and therefore relationships tend to not work out. So why do we keep looking for these? Why do we try to find happiness in all the wrong places, reposing our love in the wrong people? Because these relationships are natural to us. This is what the soul wants. This is what the soul is hankering for. Prabhupada explained this in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi 1.156. Prabhupada said, in the spiritual world, there are five kinds of relationships with the Supreme Lord, Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. The perverted reflections of these rasas are found in the material world. Land, home, furniture, and other inert material objects are related to Shanta, or the neutral relationship, whereas servants work in the Dasya relationship. Reciprocation between friends is called Sakya, the affection of a parent for a child is Vatsalya, and the affairs of conjugal love constitute Madhurya. These five relationships in the material world are distorted reflections of the original pure sentiments, which should be understood and perfected in relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. In the material world, the perverted rasas bring frustration. If these rasas are reestablished with Lord Krishna, the result is eternal blissful life. So when we say that these relationships must be reposed in the appropriate or the proper person, it means that we are meant to love Krishna under the guidance of the spiritual master to revive these relationships that we have. So it's described here in this verse that one who is advanced, such as the Avaduta Brahman, feels the presence of Krishna within their heart, and they actively have that relationship. So the relationship is there, and one is very, very satisfied. And that enables one to become detached from material relationships. Artificial relationship, the neti-neti idea of the impersonalist, does not work. Doesn't work because you cannot simply negate relationship, because relationship is our spiritual nature. So devotional service transfers our attachment from material relationship to spiritual relationship. Bhagavad Gita 7.19 says, after many births and deaths, one who is actually acknowledged surrenders unto me. Knowing me to be the cause of all causes, such a great soul is very rare. Srila Prabhupada says in the purport, when one is further advanced, he can understand their activities in the spiritual life, and these activities constitute devotional service. Realizing this, he becomes attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrenders to him. At such a time, one can understand that Lord Shri Krishna's mercy is everything, and he is the cause of all causes, and this material manifestation is not independent from him. Thus, he thinks of everything in relationship to Vasudeva Shri Krishna. Such a universal vision of Vasudeva precipitates when full surrender to the Supreme Lord Krishna as the highest goal. Such great souls are very rare. And that's part of the problem also. These great souls are very rare. So this is the perfect stage of realization when one understands Krishna, who Krishna is, one's relationship with Krishna, you know, and therefore is completely self-satisfied. But in the early stages, even one who becomes a devotee, we often do not directly perceive our relationship with Krishna. We know theoretically that Krishna is a super soul in the heart, Krishna is always there, Krishna is right here on the altar in the deity form, Radha Shyama Sundar. We are with Krishna, we are seeing Krishna. But in a neophyte stage, we don't fully realize that. And often when we walk out of the temple, we don't think about Krishna so much. So we're not on the platform of the avaduta who always feels that spiritual bliss within. However, we can begin to develop spiritual relationship and spiritual experience. Often our spiritual relationships are first with the devotees. If we don't experience Krishna directly, we can experience Krishna through Krishna's part and parcels, his devotees, his servants. So the Sadhu Sangha Association, very, very important for spiritual advancement. We form those relationships, you know, and we repose our love, our affection, our relationships with the devotees. And of course, most importantly, with the spiritual masters. And I said in plural, I was thinking about, we have this disciple course coming up. And one of the things that we talk about in the disciples course is that the spiritual master is plural. Of course, the very, very important relationship with the Diksha Guru, the initiating guru, and that is what our newer devotees are preparing for, to take Diksha. But we also have to remember that there is also Shiksha Guru. Most of us met other devotees other than our spiritual master first. And those devotees helped us, and they led us. I was fortunate that even before I joined the temple, I was able to see Srila Prabhupada personally, you know, but it's not like I had this close relationship, personal relationship, and, you know, spoke with Srila Prabhupada. No, it was very distant. Saw Srila Prabhupada, give a class or two, something like that. So it was the devotees that actually taught me and trained me and showed me what devotional service was, how to do everything, instructed me, right? You know, just helped me all along through the process of becoming a devotee and helped me to deepen my relationship with my Diksha Guru, Srila Prabhupada. So we take shelter of Shiksha Guru, of Diksha Guru. We give, you know, of course, great respect to our Vartma Vidarshana Gurus, those devotees who may have first brought us to Krishna consciousness. And of course, all of us, whether direct disciples or not, understand Srila Prabhupada as the preeminent Shiksha Guru for all devotees within this International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And that relationship with Srila Prabhupada is available to every devotee. And we can relate to Srila Prabhupada through his books, through his words. He has left us so much, such an incredible amount of material to be able to understand Srila Prabhupada. So in all these ways, we are developing relationships. Relationships with Guru, relationship with Srila Prabhupada, and relationship with all of our god brothers and god sisters, or nephews, nieces, aunts, uncles. All of those relationships are there within our ISKCON society, and that is one of the reasons that Srila Prabhupada, in his seven purposes, created this ISKCON society as a place for devotees to come together, to take shelter, as a place for devotees to be able to have this sadhu sangha. So our devotee relationships are completely different from the material relationships that find us becoming burned in this material existence. The devotee relationships are different. They are spiritual to the degree, in essence, because Krishna is the center. Of course, they may also become materialistically influenced to the degree that they're influenced by karma, jnana, and other things other than bhakti. So if our material desires are very strong, if our needs for enjoyment are very strong, it interferes with the spiritual nature of our relationships, because we may see others as being someone who will fulfill my material desires. So to that degree, that inhibits the spiritual relationship. So the devotees are always looking to spiritualize those relationships and have them less and less material component. And of course, that is a process. That's the process of bhakti as we make advancement in Krishna consciousness. So for many of us, particularly in a community like this, we find that very difficult to be on this level, like this brahmachari, brahman that we're reading about. So many people take to household life. But we understand that the aim of grihastha life, or all relationships, whatever relations are with different devotees, is for spiritual advancement. That becomes the goal. And just like there's affection in families due to common parents, we understand that we are all part of Krishna's family. So there's a natural affection. There's natural relationships between the devotees. Krishna's common father, Srila Prabhupada's common father, we are all, of course, the sons and daughters, the children of those common fathers, and therefore, there's naturally relationship. So we want to be part of Krishna's family, but we don't want that to be a dysfunctional family. We want that to be a healthy family that has loving relationships. And particularly, of course, in our house of life, we want that. The answer is very simple, of course, that Krishna has to be the center. If Krishna is the center, then it's healthy. It's spiritual. Not always so easy, though. How do we keep Krishna in the center of relationships? Often this comes down to very simple answers. If service is there and our sadhana is there, then naturally the relationships become spiritual. And it also helps if we understand the common purpose that we have. In other words, we are all coming together as devotees of Krishna. We want to serve our guru, we want to serve Prabhupada, we want to serve this great mission of ISKCON. And so if we are working together within that service mission, then naturally those relationships become enhanced and they're naturally spiritual. So I think it's very important that within families, that we share service, not just everybody is some island, you know, I'm doing my service here, you're doing their service there, you know, all right, well, see you later, and, you know, no relationship. Then problems can come about, misunderstandings can come about, so many difficulties may be there, there may be separation, or who knows. And usually if there's separation, it's totally artificial because someone just goes on to another partner. You know, it's not because they become so advanced and so renounced. And we've seen that over and over again, you know. So best thing is to work through relationships and make those relationships Krishna conscious. Make Krishna the center, you know, through our service together, through our hearing and chanting and sadhana, through association of devotees, and through our devotional practice. And then family life becomes successful, or any relationships that we have become successful. And so we need to carefully balance our different duties. You know, it's not as though, and everyone who is in family life knows that the primary activity that goes on is we all sit and read Srimad Bhagavatam together. I mean, that might be a nice ideal, but we know that there are so many other duties that are there. And often people are working jobs and doing so many things to maintain their household life that sometimes it becomes a difficulty. But we have to make a conscious effort to make this balance. We have to make the effort to make the balance, you know, that our spiritual life is part of it, that some sadhana, some hearing, some chanting, some devotional activity is also there. And then everything else becomes fine. Everything else becomes spiritualized. You know, sometimes people, you know, I get this question all the time. Someone just asked me a couple weeks ago, you know, they say, well, you know, I have to work all day. How do I see that as devotional service? And I recall that something I told them, I said, I heard Prabhupada say once, if I'm following the words of spiritual master, I chant 16 rounds. He said, then everything else I do during the day is Krishna conscious. Right? If one has the foundation, if one is situated within one's spiritual life, one is under the internal potency, the internal energy of Krishna, by virtue of following the directions of Guru, then everything one does is spiritual. Not that we're pure devotees and everything, we can just do anything. Of course not.
One has to use one's intelligence. But the fact of the matter is, whatever we're doing, somehow or another, if we have other, more, we might say, material dharma, it's not really material. Prabhupada was talking about management in ISKCON. He says, there is the spiritual side and there's the material side. He says, but it's not material. Because if you're managing, you know, for Krishna within a society, he said, it's spiritual. It's not like if you're doing the finances and you're keeping the books, that that's a material activity. When you chant Hare Krishna, that's spiritual. No, it's all spiritual. Krishna is the center. And all activity is directly or indirectly for the service of Krishna. So, I'm going to finish here by one of our most wonderful examples from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhyalila 7.126.129. Y'all remember what that story is about? So he was memorized verses. Kurma Brahma. Okay, that was... I had to ask one question that somebody wouldn't know. Okay. we have such a spiritually literate audience here that, you know, you have to keep a step ahead, everyone. Okay. Lord Chaitanya met a very spiritually advanced Brahmin priest in South India named Kurma, who became overwhelmed with devotion to our Lord Chaitanya and wished to leave his family and join him in his travels and preaching. We used to see that back in the 70s. I got a little fired up, you know, Prabhupada, I want to take sannyas and leave my family. Right? The Brahmin begged Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, my dear Lord, kindly show me favor and let me go with you. I can no longer tolerate the waves of misery caused by materialistic life. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu replied, don't speak like that again. Better to remain at home and chant the holy name of Krishna always. Instruct everyone to follow the orders of Lord Sri Krishna as they are given in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. In this way, become a spiritual master and try to liberate everyone in this land. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu further advised the Brahmin Kurma, if you follow this instruction, your materialistic life at home will not obstruct spiritual advancement. Indeed, if you follow these regular principles, we will again meet here, or rather, you will never lose my company. And of course, we know Srila Prabhupada famously would say that I am never alone. I'm always with my spiritual master. I'm always with Krishna. So just as the Avadhuta Brahma was able to travel alone, Kevalatmana, not needing anyone else, an example of Srila Prabhupada was like that. You know, someone who always felt Krishna within his heart, always felt the instructions of his guru within his heart. And so we should strive for that. But while we were striving for that perfect position, we take shelter of the relationships of the devotees of Krishna. And that keeps us situated in a safe place for spiritual advancement. Thank you all very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. I didn't realize Maharaj is here first. Like, would you like to add something, Maharaj? Or would you? No? Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for being here. I didn't get a chance to welcome you and offer my gratitude for you coming and visiting us. So thank you so much, Maharaj. Right. We had some very interesting relationships and together in Mayapur this year. We both went out on the Ganges to, to put ashes of departed friends and relatives in the Ganges together. And that was, I really felt grateful and thankful that you were there with, you know, some of your disciples and devotees. You know, it just made the whole experience really nice that we were sort of sharing in a kind of difficult, but, you know, in some way, you know, very ecstatic kind of celebration to offer the ashes of our, you know, departed friends and Vaishnavas back to Ganges. So thank you for that. I appreciated that very much. Jamastami Prabhu.
There's a reference that Prabhupada wanted us to discuss from different angles of vision. So here's a reference that seems to be a little contradictory to what was the point that was being made in class today. Mm-hmm. This is Madhya 22.83. This is Chaitanya's instructions to Sanatana Goswami. Krishna Bhakti Janma Mula Hoya Sadhu Sangha. Krishna Prema Janma Kemho Puna Mukya Anga. The root cause of devotional service to Lord Krishna is association with advanced devotees. Even when one's dormant love for Krishna awakens, association with devotees is still most essential. I just kind of want to open that up for discussion. There's one other point. Yep, Nandan Swami, he was the principal of the Bhaktivedanta College for many years, and he did a master's degree and fell down from sannyas within ISKCON, and he interviewed many devotees that had left the ashram.
And he wrote a nice book about it that he just published, right?
Oh, he did, okay. I actually haven't read it, but I kind of know what the essence of his finding was.
Yeah.
Just from talking with him. And that was that that practically every single devotee that left the sannyas ashram did so because they felt isolated, and they weren't able to connect with other devotees. So anyway, I just wanted to throw this one out for you to maybe.
Well, yeah. Again, you know, Prabhupada said to be able to hold simultaneously different or somewhat inconsistent positions is a sign of intelligence. So we have to often balance many things like this in Krishna consciousness, but on one hand it's here and one hand it's there. So yes, association is critical. We see that example that, and I've actually heard that before, and anecdotally I think that really confirms many of our experience where we've seen fall downs. It's often because of lack of association, but not having a good association, feeling isolated. So this is a very, very advanced platform of this Avadhuta Brahman who's able to just completely see Krishna in his heart. You know, so he is and has association, but he has that association within his heart with Krishna. If we're not on that platform, then we absolutely, and I shouldn't even say that. First of all, we have to be on that platform to not have association with devotees, and even those who are on that platform relish the association of devotees. You know, and we appreciate being with other devotees and being able to share devotional service. After all, this is the Sankirtan movement, which means congregationally, right? So that is our movement. And so we could almost, and I don't even know, does anyone know what yuga or what, when this is a story is happening? Probably not Kali Yuga, for sure, right? And there was, in other words, someone who had this kind of advancement of this Avadhuta Brahma. I'm not sure when King Yadu was around. But probably Satya Yuga or Treta Yuga or something. Was it Rupa Yuga? Okay. Yeah. That's a good point, though. Thank you. Yeah. But then, Mahaprabhu?
I was thinking how in the Bhagavad Gita, 1837, it mentions that happiness in the mode of passion starts off like nectar and then turns to poison.
Mm.
And then it talks about happiness in the mode of goodness starts off like poison, but then turns to nectar because of self-realization. So then the Krishna explains, be happy by sacrifice, 1310 in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, you can be happy by sacrifice. And then in 18.5, he says that the marriage ceremony is one of these sacrifices, the Vivaha Jagga. So if you take the first part when you're still in the honeymoon section and start a strong Krishna consciousness, then you can take the nectar from the mode of passion. And by the time that wears out, you've already got the nectar from the mode of goodness going, and then you can sustain it. So that's how the happiness comes from sacrifice.
Okay, so you can there's our platform. Thank you. Everybody can remember that process.
It's actually how it works, though.
Yeah. I mean, where the initial nectar is wearing off and becoming poison, the so-called poison of renunciation or austerity of Krishna consciousness, that builds more and more happiness, which will counteract the other. Thank you. That's it. Pran Govinda Prabhu?
I was thinking that Avadhuta Maharaj, we see in the progression of our spiritual life, according to Vibhuga Simpad and Nectar Devotion, that one has to come to the platform of Santa. Without Santa, there is no Dasya.
Santa, peaceful?
Yeah, peaceful. Hmm. And the definition of Santa, Mahaprabhu gave in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that Sarga Moksha Krishna Bhakta Narakkari Mane Krishna Nishta Krishna Tek Santa Degani. That one has to come in contact with the Supreme Brahman through devotional service to an extent that we are internally he has a feeling of enjoyment in heaven or liberation is no different than living in hell or experience of hell. In other words, he has no attachment for anything except this. But he hasn't possessed a deep relationship with the Lord yet, where the pure devotional service on that relation base not begun yet. But he is very peaceful inside, and outside he is adjusting, because outside always some trouble, but inside, so that stage is like compulsory, it looks like. And then when he develops his relationship with the Lord, then a particular form of God he devout and built a very strong relationship. That's why the beginning of servitorship of Dasharas.
So, if I heard what you were saying, that in the beginning one may have not developed fully, obviously, one's relationship with Krishna, but then still the peacefulness that Shanti is beginning. And I was thinking about that also. We hear from the Nectar Devotion, you know, in the six stages of, or qualities of devotional service, right in the beginning is that Rakshikna, you know, the elimination of suffering. And it's explained by the Acharyas that that comes even in the beginning stages of sadhana. So as you're saying, right in the beginning, we experience that relief from suffering. And that's something I think we could all in our own lives testify to. And therefore that shanti or peacefulness comes about. Yeah, thank you. Nice point. Yes, Mother Mahamaya.
Hare Krishna. So, we have a record in this world, as well as in ISKCON, that when our marital relationships are not going smoothly, that often the wife ends up getting abused. And I know in
ISKCON, say that
what? I'm saying that women are vulnerable and getting abused
okay.
in marital relationships. And
okay.
In ISKCON, we recognize, you know, we need to protect children. We were in charge of the office for some years, and I mean, everybody would agree that children need to be protected. And I see this growing admission of women's protection plan, you know, some organization that will deal with that, because it's going on.
You're preaching the choir. I agree with you 100%.
Okay, so how do we get this happening? How to get it started, because it doesn't exist. I mean, the term is called domestic violence.
Yeah.
And I thought that, you know, the women's ministry, but it's really not a women's ministry, it's more like a hostile ministry.
Well, all of these ministries, to be honest with you, are very limited in their actual resources and scope and responsibilities and what they can do. I mean, they're all trying. I remember I talked to some degree years back. I was working a little bit with when I was with the Child Protection, working with the women's ministry and how we could do something about. Now we do have, of course, in North America, we have a pastoral abuse office, you know, which is where there's exploitation, abuse of those in some power, often with women like that. But as far as within domestic relationships, it's always been difficult because, first of all, it's very personal, very private, and secondly, it's like, because most of our, we're mostly congregationally based, and it's not like we have so many like household couples who are sort of under the temple authorities. You know, we don't have a lot of control there for people who are living outside and what's going on. It doesn't mean though that we shouldn't use moral and spiritual authority to do the right thing. And, I don't have an easy answer for you about what should be done, but absolutely it should. Obviously, and there's one story, I'm not going to mention names, but one devotee told me about years ago, I mean, you know, obviously in the early 70s, that his sister was a devotee, he was a devotee, and his sister was being abused by her husband, and he took his sister to Prabhupada, I mean physically abused. And Prabhupada was very upset, and he actually said that she could leave him if he continued that. So, I mean, it's nothing that Prabhupada ever sanctioned, ever thought was okay. In fact, that's pretty drastic, because we don't believe in separation, we don't believe in divorce. In that case, Prabhupada even said you could leave him if he's doing that. So, we know that that's the right thing, and it's something we need to work together more as in our society.
Okay.
And I'd be glad to talk to you more later, you know, if you have any ideas or anything. You know, I'm kind of beyond the scope, I think, of our class right now. But it's a good point to bring up. Anything else?
I have a
Oh, yes.
It seems like the early years in Seminary is shaky because, you know, there's something going on just into the other person.
Yeah.
You have to hold the words. That's
okay. Okay. That's good?
That's good.
Yeah. No.
just keep it right like this. Yeah.
Okay.
There.
Yeah.
It's okay. She's got it. Go ahead.
Okay. I hear two different speeches.
You know, the man and the woman?
The man and the
woman. No, go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, you're going through all this adjustment, and Krishna is not usually so much in the focus because, you know, it's a whole different meditation.
Yeah.
And later on, as you take more shelter of Krishna, you know, you realize that this person is a devotee, and, you know, he has his own relationship, sort of, and another relationship. Then the kids come along, and things get a little more complicated again, you're trying to take care. So, in your experience, as a grihastha, you're very successful grihastha, is there some more concrete example, or...
You said something that was very important. You said, when you realize that your husband or wife is a devotee. And I think that's very critical and a good realization that you had. In other words, it's not that I have relationships with devotees and you talk about offenses and everything inside of the Sangha, but somehow it's different. In my marriage, we forget that the husband and wife, that they're also devotees. And so we also have to, as well as this relationship we may have with them as husband and wife, there also has to be this relationship that this is a devotee, and I can offend the devotee, and I want to make sure that our relationships are spiritual, you know, and that we have that spiritual relationship. And it becomes more difficult because there's a lot of strains, you know, in family life. And, you know, things that tend to work against that a little bit, you know. But I think that if that consciousness is there, that these are all devotees, my family, they are devotees, our goal is to become Krishna conscious, to help one another in Krishna consciousness, you know, then I think then there's a lot of other stuff that just has to be worked out, you know. But as long as we keep that consciousness and goal understood, you know, then we'll keep working towards it. Okay, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you very much.